Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you. Hello and welcome to CICK News. Today's episode is a special one as I got the opportunity to speak with two people who are instrumental in the creation and reality of raising a new totem pole on Wet'suwet'en territory. These people are Bertie Markert and Sigot Ron Austin. Bertie is the district principal for Indigenous Student Services at SD 54. Her work has been instrumental for the students of SD 54, and last year she was awarded the Premier's Award for Excellence in Indigenous Education. I spoke with Bertie to learn about how this totem pole came to be and what message will be portrayed once the pole is up on what was once called Indian Town on that land. Indian Town was a Wet'suwet'en neighborhood which once stood on the outskirts of Smithers, situated between Queen Street and Chicken Creek and up toward the hospital, according to a map in Shared Histories by Tyler McCreary. Slowly squeezed off their land, the Wet'suwet'en, or people of the Lower Hills, watched as new infrastructure and industry transformed their traditional land and consequently their way of life. The following history of Indian Town is from excerpts that I will read from BC's Untold History by Ben Musset and Shared Histories by Tyler McCreary. The Wet'suwet'en people tried hard to adapt to their new reality, engaging in the new wage-based economy and attempting to homestead as the settlers did. Unfortunately, the newcomers and government often stood in their way. The BC government's land policies made it very difficult for Indigenous families to preempt desired land, to stake claim to Crown territory for settlement or farming, while allowing settlers to preempt vast territories across the province. Often, Wet'suwet'en families who did somehow establish farms on non-reserve land would still be run off by incoming settlers, backed up by the strong arm of the law. Many of these families moved to reserves, or the edge of Smithers, aka Indian Town. This pattern of Indigenous displacement repeated itself across British Columbia. Located along what is now Highway 16, Indian Town was known for its large homes, frequent visitors, and vibrant atmosphere. But nearly from the beginning, non-Indigenous Smithers residents resented their Wet'suwet'en neighbors, who they often labeled squatters. The municipality refused to provide the community with modern infrastructure like paved roads or waste collection, even though homeowners in Indian Town paid their property taxes, just like other Smithers residents. As early as 1926, townspeople presented officials with a petition urging them to prohibit, quote, the ownership of land within the municipality by Indians or other colored folks, end quote. Town officials deferred to the province, which informed them this practice was illegal. In the 1930s, a young girl from Indian Town named Agnes died at the LeJack Indian Residential School at Fraser Lake. Her grieving father, Jack Joseph, an influential Wet'suwet'en community leader, resolved to stop any children from returning there. A day school was opened in the nearby Morristown Reserve, but it proved more difficult to protect children living in Indian Town. Smithers officials refused to allow Indigenous kids to attend the local public school. In response, many homeowners in Indian Town, who had long been denied basic services, stopped paying their property taxes. But the town wouldn't budge. Instead, officials confiscated the deeds to their homes. Indigenous children did not begin attending public school in Smithers until the 1940s. Following the tax revolt, Smithers made repeated attempts to erase Indian Town altogether. Quote, nevertheless, writes Tyler McCreary, Wet'suwet'en families persisted on the municipal fringe, claiming a right to a place in town through their resourcefulness and perseverance, end quote. But by the 1960s, Smithers had begun inducing homeowners in Indian Town to sell to make way for motels, laundromats, and other businesses. The Wet'suwet'en community was once more displaced and scattered to the margins, where they would again face pressure to disappear. In May 1967, the family of Jack Joseph's son Louis was the last to be evicted. The town avoided paying compensation for the family's home by condemning the building and setting it aflame.
My name is Bertie Markert. I'm the district principal for Indigenous Student Services. If you were in our feast hall, you would call me Ildesanon. I'm from the Lux'iliuk clan, from the House of Many Eyes.
So what is the significance of the pole that's being raised in front of Walnut Park on the 29th?
I'm very excited about the fact that we're raising a pole on lands that once was home to many Wet'suwet'en families before contact. And we had many Wet'suwet'en families that lived there at one time. And obviously, you know, that colonization comes with very complicated and many layers of history mm-hmm. with regard to folks trying to share living on one in one space. Yeah. My grandfather, Arthur Michel, had a home there, and my great-grandfather, Arthur Michel, had a home there. And my mom's dad and my grandma lived there at one point, but they were moved out of that area and pushed out. And so Jack Joseph was a leader that lived in this community, and we had different rules at that time through colonization where the government decided that Wet'suwet'en children needed to go to residential school, and the public schools here were for settler community students and children. And so there was an accident that happened at the Jack School where Mr. Joseph lost his daughter due to an accident at the school, and he decided that he was going to organize the Wet'suwet'en families that lived here to not pay taxes. They were paying taxes, but they were not necessarily getting the service, so their kids weren't going to school here. Mm-hmm. And so once there was a tax revolt, the town shut off the water, shut off the electricity, and pushed out the Wet'suwet'en families. And so all the deeds that were left there because of the taxes that weren't paid reverted to the provincial government. And once the Wet'suwet'en families were moved out, the town of Smithers purchased back those deeds. Okay. And so the significance of having a totem pole on that property that once housed many Wet'suwet'en families, and that's basically from Aspen all the way to Bulkley Valley Museum, that whole frontage road. Yeah. Wet'suwet'en families live there. And it's really interesting. I was just there a few days ago with one of our hereditary chiefs, and he remembers living there, and this tree that he used to play in still stands there.
Wow.
Right? So it's something that I think the district and the town and the regional district have, you know, put their efforts behind. And I really feel like we are in a really good place to be acknowledging our past and wanting to move forward and forge good, healthy relationships together.
Yeah. Did you spearhead this project, or who started talking about this?
I have a feeling it was our superintendent, Mr. McDermott. He realized that we were a part of the challenge because the public school, he's the leader of a public school. Once we were a part of that story, that we needed to change that story. And mm-hmm. so changing that story meant that we were going to look at a way to reconcile and remember that history.
Yeah. What do you think students will understand about where they live and go to school and play when once the totem pole is unveiled? Do you think that there will be an understanding, or is there a conversation that goes along with it for especially the students at Walnut Park?
I think a lot of students have already been aware of that history because last year and the year before, students were making regular trips to visit the totem pole where it was being carved in Kisan, so that they were providing some of their ideas and thoughts on what that pole should look like or what should be on the pole. So it really truly is a collaborative pole because we had many people go and visit it. And it's the very first like 360 pole. So you'll have images on all sides of that pole. Mm-hmm. So I know that the students at Walnut Park are learning about the history of that land because there was a poster at the school. And I know that the support staff there are working with the teachers to ensure that the story is being shared. I feel that teachers are being really thoughtful and working toward ensuring their students are aware of that history.
How the school district is approaching that education aspect that's got to go along with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the carvers of the pole?
We have a master carver. He's carved many poles. His name is Ron Austin. He's one of our hereditary chiefs. He's got poles all over the world. And he, this is probably a question that you should have for him. He's got poles in France and in Germany. And we have a family pole that's in France that was taken. Like they're bringing a pole back to the Naas Valley. We have one of those poles that are still out there that was taken from us at that same time when Maurice Barbeau was going through here. So I know that there's conversations about that pole as well. Yeah. So the carver is, you got Ron Austin. He's the master carver. His hands is a Gitxsan carver. He has ancestry to the Wet'suwet'en, and that's Dan Yunks. He carves at the carving shed in Kisan. Mm-hmm. And he's a pretty amazing carver. He loves talking with students and working through the pole with students. That was something that he really appreciated. He's a great storyteller. Yeah. And we had two apprentices that were with us for a very brief time. And that was Ron Austin Jr. and Delina Cull. Yeah. Excellent. So those are the folks that had their hands on the pole.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want that is important for people to know about the placement of the pole, the design of it, or just the significance of it that I didn't ask you about?
It's interesting. Speaking with the chiefs and elders over the past little while, it's really important that this is a celebration of us working together, collaborating, and acknowledging the past and moving forward. To me, there's a real like positive energy around how this pole is being embraced by our community. And I'm very happy about that. And I think that it's going to be a wonderful event. I'm looking forward to it. Feels like it's taken 2 years to get here. And the funny thing is I've never really been a part of organizing and responding to having a totem pole being erected. There was one at Smithers Secondary School in May 1999, and that's 25 years ago this May.
Whoa.
And so I wasn't a part of that. So to be a part of a new conversation of putting a pole in front of a school is pretty darn amazing. And I'm really quite excited to see it, you know, stand there and let people know who drive past that pole from the highway. You can see it from the highway.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited for folks to see that Wet'suwet'en people are still here.
It's beautiful. I guess I do have one last question that's maybe a little more logistical. How is the pole actually being raised?
Actually, when we raise a totem pole, we have clan speeches and dances at each level. So there's 5 clans, so it'll be lifted certain points along the way until it's standing wreck. We can't do that because the pole is just too massive and too heavy.
Okay.
That it's just going to, we're going to have all the ceremony at the very base of the pole while the pole is still sitting on the flatbed truck. We're having our ceremony there. Then we're clearing the area. And then once the area is cleared of folks, and we have all these safety measures that have to be in place to make sure that the people that are hoisting the pole are able to do it and not worry about the rest of us, that then the pole will go up. They say that it might take 3 to 4 hours to get the pole up and like locked into place.
Yeah.
We're not going to stand out there and watch it for that whole time. So what we're going to do is we'll have our ceremony before the pole is moved. And once we're all cleared out, we may stand and watch for a half an hour or an hour. Then we'll move into the gymnasium and we'll have a feast to acknowledge the hiring and pay all of our workers that have been working on that pole.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming, Kamala.
The pole is being raised on Friday, September 29th in commemoration of Truth and Reconciliation Day in Canada at Walnut Park School. Now, for those who can't attend, and even for those who can, the next segment of today's news is a special treat. Tsigot Ron Austin is a master carver. He designed the pole that will be raised on Friday, and it was carved by Gitxsan artist Dan Yunks along with students under Dan's tutelage in Kisan. I met Hereditary Chief Tsigot where the pole is being held until Friday, and this following audio is him walking me through the elements of the pole one by one.
My name, my My traditional name, Jikot, means from the heart. My English name is Ron Austin. I've been doing art since 1974. Or I've been doing art all my life, actually.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. And yeah, which, if you want to start at this end and work your way up, or do you usually start from the top down?
The bottom of the pole is the most important because it has a crest of the person, the caretaker, the owner of the territory. This happens to be the bear, the grizzly bear territory. So at the bottom, they have the bear. We can't actually see it because it's on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And here's his ears. Mm. It's got little creatures in there. And up here, you see the little faces. You'll see the little faces there.
Yeah.
They're representing the students, like the elementary students. Oh. The faces with little flowers, like they're just emerging.
Yeah.
And then these little people on the bottom here somewhere, they're coming out of a walnut. They're emerging from a walnut because of the Walnut Elementary School. And above here you have the big frog. Apparently the bottom, the grizzly bear, is a Wasa's crest, the Gidimdan crest. The bear crest at the bottom, the Gidimdan. And up here we have the big frog, mm-hmm. the Gitxaurhu clan. They also have little children in their eyes, mm-hmm. representing the students. A lot of representation of the students. Here you see the bear's ear, mm-hmm. and also some more little faces of the children, representing the children of Walnut Park. Mm-hmm. This part here is a killer whale. Killer whale fireweed, the Lhtxamasiu clan. The killer whale clan, the fireweed clan. They have two houses, the owl and the sun house, that come under the fireweed clan. The tail in the back again with a little face on it. Then here we have the small frog. Small frog blends in with the beaver's tail. That's a Lhtxilu, the small frog. The crest, and also called Galantan. Further east, the Lhtxilu clan, the crest changes to a caribou as we go further east of the small frog clan.
And you said this is caribou. These look like scales. What are these here?
These represent the crosshatch of the beaver's tail.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a crosshatch, how the beaver's tail is.
Yeah, okay.
And it encompasses part of the small frog here.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have a little face, and you can see that the face is starting to mature as they're going up the pole, representing that the students are growing older and they're making a travel through different things in their life. Some more face inside the eyes of the beaver. And then some more faces of the mature.
Uh-huh.
And then on top here we have, this is a chief sitting here, representing the chief. That's a final succession of the students. They'll make it to the highest possible level they can, mm-hmm. representing this chief. Then they when they've accomplished their goals in life.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that people know to sort of interpret the pole from the bottom to the top? I think it's natural for us to kind of look up and cascade down.
Yeah, for quite a while it was believed that they always said that you're on the top of the totem pole. Actually, it's the bottom of the totem pole that's the most important part that carries the chief's crest and the clan crest of the area.
Now, you worked with, so this was your design, and then it was Dan Junks who did the carving, or were
did
you working
rendition
together?
Rendition of the idea, yeah. Dan Junks did the rendition of his idea. Mm-hmm. Very elaborate work that he did.
Yeah.
Really elaborate from all the way he plays with sunlight.
Yeah.
And the different textures.
Mm-hmm. And a split like this that happened. Looks like it must have been after the carving process,
yeah,
as well.
That's inevitable because the core of the wood, the outside shrinks before the center. The center stays moist and at the same size, and the wood around it shrinks and starts opening up.
Mm-hmm. And where was this tree from originally? Do you know?
I think it was from Kitimat area.
Yeah.
It was picked up in Terrace. From a log broker there. He most likely got it in the Kitimat area.
And it's cedar?
Red cedar is starting to become hard to find nowadays. Big red cedar, totem pole size cedar.
Yeah.
It looks so straight down when you look at it.
Oh yeah. You try to pick the most straightest pole. Mm-hmm. And the grain and the knots are important, but you can't avoid knots. There's always knots, but.
Yeah. And then, so because this pole is also commemorating what was called by settlers Indian Town, do you feel like this helps tell the story and informs people with the order? Starting at the Grizzly Bear Clan and including the Frog Clan, do you feel like this represents the people long before settlers came to Smithers?
Yes, it does. Our crests haven't changed, and our chief names are handed down from centuries, from time immemorial, as they say. And so our crests have always stayed with us. Yeah, that's important part of our groups, how we do our governing and how we distribute our wealth, because we're a communal society. We always distributing our wealth during feasts and different occasions, during deaths, during stone raising, during names. Always runs into a lot of gifts being given away and a lot of food given away, and it's really it's always a really prestigious and expensive undertaking. Pole raising is really some. It's a great thing to represent wealth and culture.
Right. Yeah.
And will you be there? Will you be at the pole raising?
Yes, I'm probably going to have to probably do some speaking there and in our language and in English to explain the pole.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else about the pole or the carving or the design of it that you think is important for people to know or hear about this before they can see it in person?
Actually, this pole here is going to be stood up, but there's songs and the feasts that the people can come to and witness how we do our governance, because there's a lot of governance going into raising a pole and talking about a pole and the crests, like the people's crests and the areas that the territories that they're caretakers of. Our boundary goes from outside Burns Lake to Seville Creek, east to Porfer Creek, outside of Hazelton there, that's where our boundary run, and then from there west is Kitsan Territory.
When the pole is actually being raised, it gets raised and then it pauses, right? Like it's held for a little while, yeah. Suspended. Can you, I guess, talk me through the process of that and what's happening at the moments when it's being suspended and held before moving on?
When it first goes up, they pick a clan to do a speech. It's raised an increment at first, and there's five clans, so it's shifted upwards five times until it's erect. When it's erect, the Bear Clan is the last one that does the talking of their territory and why this pole and the crests on it and what it represents. So each time you lift the pole, one clan comes out, sings their song, and they do their speech, that clan, and then the next clan all the way until the five clans have finished their speech and their songs, and then the last one was the Bear. The Bear is the owner, and they do their last speech and talk about their territory and what this pole represents. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's beautiful, and I think that it's going to be one of those things that, without it being there, there's something absent. As soon as it's there, the area will feel more complete, I think.
The feast will also teach people our culture. That's, I think, the most important part. Indian Town, I witnessed Indian Town. I was just a little toddler when we used to go there. My grandfather had a house there and loaned it to his brother-in-law. And we used to go visit him all the time. We lived in Hagelgate, but we always came to this area here called Kinuskat, top of the swamp.
Yeah.
That's the Indian name for Smithers, Kinuskat, top of the swamp.
Yeah.
Quite a few of my cousins got sent to residential school and the regular villagers, mm-hmm. but my grandfather and grandmother didn't want my brother Frank or my sister Louise to go to residential school, so they sent us out to... We lived out in the Trapper, in just a Buckley Canyon outside of Hazleton there.
Yep.
That's where we were raised up, and when we were little children, we were taught the culture, and we had our own little trap line, snaring rabbits and grouse and whatnot when we were little, tiny little guys.
Yeah,
my grandfather, that was probably the last deadfall that was ever used was at that camp. I witnessed my grandfather trapping a bull moose in a
wow.
in a deadfall.
Yeah.
It was quite something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think on Friday this pole's going to be raised.
Mm-hmm.
Be quite the occasion.
Yeah.
I hope we have lots of people to witness the raising.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for speaking with me and walking through the pole with me. This really means a lot.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to Millie Gunanute. I got all the information for anyone in the public who's interested in attending the pole raising feast and ceremony. First off, it'll begin at 10 a.m. at the Bulkley Valley Museum. We'll meet the pole there and we'll be led by the hereditary chiefs to walk the pole to school. Following the walk, the feast and ceremony will take place while the pole is being raised. The pole is not being raised traditionally, as both Tsigot and Birdie mentioned, due to its sheer mass and size. The public is welcome, and parking is available at the arena across the highway from the school, because the school parking is reserved for elders, so please do not show up and plan to park at Walnut Park School. Pictures and videos are allowed, however, there will be no recording, and this warning will be said at the feast and ceremony, but there will be no recording during Sinech, which is the sacred prayer. Thank you very much to Birdie Markert and Tsigot Ron Austin for giving me the time and walking me through this process, and I hope to see you out there on Friday at Walnut Park.
listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.